Let's sit.
No more.
Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is Let's Talk Social Justice with your host, Kevin Yowie.
Good morning, and you're listening to AAA Murray Country. I'm Kevin Yowie, and as a Waka Waka and South Sea Islander man, I'd like to first begin by acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians and caretakers of the lands on which I meet on. As a visitor here, I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past and present. These last few weeks, we've had a lot of talk about the recent youth justice amendments. And a few weeks ago, we were joined by Ruby Wharton and Nettery Marbo from Sisters Inside. They spoke to us about the policing and prisons in Queensland and the importance of ending toxic prisons by blowing up the pipeline between youth incarceration and the prison system. The following week, we were joined by my dear friend Jane Christian in New South Wales, who was speaking about racism both within and beyond the legal system and the challenge of addressing racist outcomes in the legal system while legal institutions themselves remain premised on racism. And of course, last week, we were joined by the Queensland Human Rights Commissioner Scott McDougall and Greens MP Michael Berkman, who spoke to us about the human rights implications of the proposed amendments and the political function of the amendments. This week, we are digging deeper into the detail of the amendments, which were passed by the Queensland Parliament on Thursday, 16th of March. These changes include a breach of bail offence for young people, a change which directly contravenes the Queensland Human Rights Act, and which the Queensland government had previously ruled out as ineffective and controversial. Go figure. It also includes a major expansion of electronic monitoring and surveillance of criminalised children, expanding the use of ankle monitors and other forms of electronic monitoring to children as young as 15. Over the course of this series, we've been trying to understand the political processes at play here and why it is that Queensland Labor government has launched towards such obviously dangerous and draconian policies. On today's show, we want to focus a bit more on exactly what this all means and the laws behind it. Here, for young people in Queensland, we know that these amendments are dangerous, but many of us don't really know exactly what they mean in practice or how they'll work. So we're really honoured to be joined this week by the CEO of Sisters Inside and practising solicitor, Deb Kilroy, to get a bit of a rundown on exactly what these amendments will mean in practice. Deb, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Kevin, and good morning, everybody.
So, Deb, just to set the context for our listeners, can you tell us a bit more about yourself and what led you to your work with Sisters Inside and Kilroy and Callaghan?
Sure. Before I continue to speak, I'd just like to acknowledge also the traditional owners of the land here, where we sit this morning at AAA, and I want to show my respect to elders past and present. I'm a colonial white settler and I have resided here in Meanjin from the time I was born here. So I was criminalised and imprisoned at the age of 13 for wagging school. So I'm actually one of those children that we're talking about today. So, you know, which is nearly 50 years ago, and nothing changes if nothing changes.
Yeah.
I suppose what's changed is it's got worse. More children are incarcerated. But, I mean, it's exactly the same thing that's happening today that happened to me as a child and those other girls that I was incarcerated with, you know, nearly 50 years ago. The last time that I was incarcerated, I was sentenced. Well, I was looking at a mandatory life sentence back then. The Drug Misuse Act came into effect in 1986, and I was arrested with my husband, Smokin' Joe Kilroy, in 88. And the offence, one of the offences that I was charged with was the penalty was a mandatory life sentence. However, by the time we got to court, October 89, negotiations were done, as they always usually done, with prosecution and defence lawyers, and they dropped the charge of mandatory life. They did a deal with Joe, so Joe pleaded to offences. They dropped my charge that constituted mandatory life, and then I was sentenced to 6 years and he was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment. That was October 89. In January 1990, my friend got stabbed to death sitting beside me in Bogger Road. And, you know, people were quite horrified because no one really knew that there was a women's prison at the back of the men's Bogger Road prison. And so what happened was all the management of that prison got moved out and moved on. New management came in, and the women became the guinea pigs, because there was only about 100 of us then in that prison, and that was overcrowded. And, you know, now we have nearly 1,000 women in our prisons in this jurisdiction, which is horrifying. But, I mean, when I came out of prison, it was like I said to the women, I'm going to come back. And screws are like, yeah, you're coming back in handcuffs. It's like, no, I'm coming back. So I came back, and the lifers and long-termers group, who I was a member of, we kept meeting, and then Sisters Inside came out of that.
Okay.
And Sisters Inside, we still have a group of women, our steering committee, inside prisons that actually are part of our management committee, and it's part of our constitution and our bylaws.
Yeah.
So legally we must have a steering committee of women in prison to be part of our board that actually directs everything we do in the organisation. So we're very much a grassroots organisation. After Debbie was murdered, education became the priority in the prison. So I call the era, like when Wayne Goss got in for the Labor government in 89 till about 92, was a little window of teeny tiny reform. And at that time, education was the priority. And so I started a social work degree. Like, I never finished school.
Oh, did you do social work, Deb?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm a little social worker.
Yeah.
I started the Bachelor of Social Work over at UQ.
Yeah, okay.
When I was in prison. Yeah. I remember going there for the first lecture. Prison officer took me, and they say, like, the first, like, intro course.
Yeah, yeah.
Subject.
Yeah.
And the lecturer's going, you know, I want you to go to a court or go to a DV shelter or go here or go there. And I'm thinking, oh, I'd done all those things. I've experienced all those things except old woman bedridden.
Yeah,
right?
So
I went down to see the lecturer then, and they knew exactly who I was, because it was the prison's education officer that went to the dean of social work over at the University of Queensland to advocate for me to be enrolled, because I never finished high school. I got kicked out at grade 8, and because I was in prison, they were a bit freaking out.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I said the lecture, look, I've experienced all them things except old woman bedroom. Hopefully I'll get to be old woman bedroom. But anyway, and she says, just go away, we'll give you the credit points. So my life was worth the 5 credit points at that time, back in the 90s. Yeah. But anyway, I finished that social work degree, and then I decided, look, because I did the social work degree because I wanted the power that the social workers had, that convinced my parents, who were poor and uneducated, and were convinced that the professionals, quote, end quote, knew what the best thing to do with me was, because I was wagging school, running away from home, right?
Yep.
And, you know, and they agreed to sign me off to, with the Juvenile Aid Bureau and the social workers, to go into prison for 4 weeks to get a psychiatric report. But, I mean, that was the slippery slope, right? I was in and out of that prison forever after, until I turned 17, and then I was put in Bogger Road at 17. But and then I decided, look, one of the real places of power is a courtroom, where if you're a lawyer, you have a right to speak and to be able to advocate for girls and women and others, you know, in our community. Because being a lawyer, you have a great privilege, and I believe we all must use that privilege as lawyers to advocate for those that can't advocate for themselves.
Absolutely.
And so, you know I was told when I'd finished my law degree by others that I would never get admitted because of my criminal history. And like I said, well, that's just another argument. Courts say every day to children and to adults, you're going to prison to get, quote, end quote, rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. I actually want you to tell me then when I'm rehabilitated. And I did get admitted, and so that's like over 15 years ago now. So, so here we are today.
And here we are. Deb, thank you, first of all, for sharing such personal stories as well. And I know you're never shy to share some of your experiences of the past, especially your time being incarcerated as well. Mm-hmm. And I know that your stories, it actually empowers others to think about different ways of fighting the system as well. So thank you for sharing your stories. And also thank you for being here today. Deb, on today's show, we're trying to understand what the amendments to the Youth Justice Act are going to mean in practice. Mm. I mean, everyone's talking about it at the moment. It's all over the news. There are 10 key changes that have been the subject of the most commentary, and we're keen to talk to you about what they will mean in practice.
Yep.
So I guess the first thing, probably the most controversial amendment to the Youth Justice Act, is the introduction of breach of bail as an offence for children.
Yes.
It is already a crime for an adult to breach their bail. Now it will also apply to children, with a maximum penalty of 1 year detention under the Youth Justice Act for breaching bail conditions. Deb, I'm wondering, what does this actually mean in practice, and what kinds of things would constitute breaching bail?
Yeah. Well, it's about breaching bail. So breaching bail in regards to conditions. So, you know, there's generic conditions, don't commit another offence, for example, show up for court when required. So, and then conditions could be you could have a residential address, children could have curfews, you know, if they're on a conditional bail program, you know, they must attend programs at YJ. And more recently, I'm seeing, I was in court last week with a little young one who'd spent 6 days in the watch house, and the bail, one of the bail conditions was a 24-hour curfew unless she was with her mother or an adult deemed reasonable in regards to YJ, not her mother, but Youth Justice.
Yeah, okay.
So an example could be any type of condition that's on your bail order. If you are not complying with that, that constitutes a breach of a bail condition. And so then that now becomes a criminal offence. But, I mean, we must understand the children that the racial gendered violence of policing, the police, who they're actually targeting. And we know that they're targeting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. That's their target, and children of colour. So when you go into any of the youth prisons here, you will predominantly see all children of colour. So when the state says that there's 70% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in a youth prison, people automatically think that the other 30% are white. That's actually not true. Usually near the other 30%, nearly, are children of colour. So Polynesian, African children. So it's not this balancing the books of white fellas are being criminalised as well as Aboriginal children. It's actually quite targeted through that lens and that action of racial gendered violence of policing. And we know that the police system is racist, misogynist, sexist, you know, they all gave evidence in the inquiry last year.
Absolutely.
All told on each other about how disgustingly racist and misogynistic and sexist they were. And even where female police officers were being, you know, sexually assaulted, etc. So this is, this piece of legislation now gives the power to police, more power than they've ever had before, in regards to not only the breach of bail condition, but there's another section that talks about if a police officer reasonably suspects that a child is going to breach their bail condition.
Yeah. Now, Deb, I was going to ask you about this. What
they have a crystal ball, right?
Yeah. It's very Minority Report. I don't know if you've seen that Tom Cruise movie, but it's almost predicting what might happen.
Yes.
And that's a very dangerous place to be in, right?
Very dangerous to give to police. Very, very dangerous, considering we know how they act now towards Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. And it's actually quite scary. I'm horrified. And in relation to that, and also the government, because they can't employ enough police, right? So what they've done is made a deal with the feds, the federal government, to bring 500 police officers from other countries, the US, South Africa.
Oh, wow.
To fill 500 positions of police every year for the next 5 years. So we bring police from those other countries and bring them and maybe send them up to North Queensland. The context is very, very different. My crystal ball.
Yeah.
And people will say, well, you ain't got a crystal ball, Kilroy. But Parliament's saying the police have a crystal ball, right?
Yeah.
In regards to children and their bail conditions. My crystal ball says there's going to be children killed. And we did see a killing by police on Saturday. Yes, Mr. Donoghue was a 28-year-old young man. That's young to me, right?
Yeah.
He's 28.
Yeah.
Quite horrendous. So, but I believe that by bringing these police who have no context or understand the nuances in regards to Aboriginal communities, we may see, probably will see, children being killed. And that's a major concern because of the power that's in that this legislation is giving to individual police officers to, quote, end quote, reasonably suspect that a child will commit, is going to commit a bail condition, right?
Yeah, it's out of this world. When I read some of the amendments that got through a couple of weeks back, Deb, I absolutely was taken back. And having managed bail programs and worked with young people in the youth justice space, and like you say, I've been out to the youth detention centre and to see the amount of black kids but also kids of colour out there is quite shocking. Deb, I'm wondering, the new amendments are very much focused on targeted policing and they rely heavily on new surveillance practices. One of these is the extension of the existing trial of GPS ankle monitors for some young people. And ankle monitors have been, for those who don't know, used as bail conditions for some 16 and 17-year-olds who have been charged with prescribed offences after being found guilty of other offences. There is basically no evidence on whether they've had any impact on reoffending, but there's lots of evidence that they are a horrible contravention of the human rights of children. Deb, I'm wondering, can you tell us a bit about the proposed extension of GPS ankle monitors to eligible 15-year-olds?
Yeah, well, basically that's already in the legislation for 16 and 17-year-olds. So they've just added 15 years and removed the other ages. So 15-year-old children can, have what we call is e-carceration, so electronic carceration. It's another form of incarceration in the community, but we know that it's failed and they were hardly ever used because children don't necessarily have phones, or if they have phones, they can't charge the e-carceration monitor. And so that's why a lot of them haven't been used. And so the millions of dollars that have been allocated has cost taxpayers a fortune. What e-carceration does is it really just, what it does is tells you where the child is. It doesn't stop
any behaviour. Yeah, that's a really good point, Deb.
And so it's about after the fact. So why are we bolstering up corporations and paying corporations millions and millions and millions of dollars of our taxpayers to put e-carceration electronic monitors around children's ankles when this bill was about community protection, protecting the community, stopping harm, stopping so-called quote-unquote crime, when we know that these electronic monitors don't do anything of the sorts? It's about after the fact. So Billy could have been down the road, something could have been happened, so they can trace where Billy was. It actually doesn't stop Billy behaving in a way that's deemed a crime, quote, end quote. So it's a waste of taxpayers' money. It's an extension of the prison industrial complex, is what we call it, and net widening more children who can be then imprisoned, because if there's something goes wrong with the e-carceration monitor or if they've been in an area, well, you know, they could be used too, like they could check where a child was and breach them then for the breach of bail condition, right? If they weren't supposed to be in a specific address.
Absolutely. And you think with all the money that they put into ankle bracelets, you know, they might look at things like housing, Deb, but, you know, that would make too much sense. Another scary change, which we touched on, is a clarification that police do not need to consider alternatives to arrest if a young person contravenes or is likely to contravene a bail condition.
Yeah, well, that's what we were talking about a minute ago, right? And I was thinking it might help people in the community, Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people in the community, to understand, like I can give an example, okay?
So,
about contravening, you know, breaching a bail condition. So we had a young one who was taken into care quite young, little Murray one, and the foster family no longer wanted her, but they didn't tell her. So she was picked up by the police, and the family policing system is what I call so-called child safety. There's nothing safe about it and no protecting about it. But anyway, and she was put in resi care.
Okay.
Now, the residential care. Right?
Yep.
And she did not know. She was 12. She did not know what was going on. She was so distressed. All she wanted to go was home to the place that she knew for a long time,
of course.
And the family policing worker rang Sisters Inside and asked us if we would tell her that the foster family no longer wants her. It's like, that is not our role. That is your role. You tell her, like, you know what I mean? We're here to support her.
Right.
Like, they wanted us to deliver the carceral news. And it's like, no, that's not our role. And so she was quite distressed. So what happened was, this is when the police started to be called. So I first met, let's call her Mary, it was because Legal Aid referred her to us.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
And it's where the police had decided to file an application in the Supreme Court to have her bail overturned. okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happened was, so when we got all the material, she'd already had charges on her criminal history, which were willful damage and going armed in public to cause fear. Now, when you think of willful damage, you go, okay, something's been damaged, right?
Okay.
You sort of get that. That's easy to understand.
Mm.
But going armed in public to cause fear, you think someone's got a knife or a gun or a machete.
That's how it sort of reads,
yeah,
doesn't
that's
it?
Right. So, but what actually happened when I got the material and had a read is that this little one, she was so distressed that she couldn't go back home to the address where the foster family was and was stuck in this residential care, not getting much care. But anyway, she was spinning out. She actually got a saucepan and she went out and sat on the gutter, and she was so distressed she was banging the saucepan on the road. So it was willful damage to the saucepan.
No.
And the going armed to cause fear in public, yeah, whilst armed, was actually banging it on the road. And the lawyers prior pleaded her out, a guilty plea.
Wow.
Now, that little one has been in and out of the youth prison. Ongoing. Now, at one stage, she got bail and she was taken to an address that she'd been to before where she'd been, and she had been sexually abused there before. Now, that had been reported to so-called, quote-unquote, child safety, and they were aware of that. She contacted us and said, I can't stay here. So she's on bail, right?
Yeah.
I cannot stay here. This man is here and I am scared I'm going to get sexually abused or raped again and I need to get out. So the child safety officer was rung and they said, no, you need to stay there. We're aware of the allegations. They haven't been investigated and this is your bail address. If you leave, you're breaching your bail and the police will call. So this is an example that... And, of course, she left and we assisted her to leave.
Yeah.
And I was more than happy to take that argument up with the authorities, right?
Absolutely.
It was about protecting her from harm, sexual violence or rape. And I really didn't care about the bail conditions because I knew that a court of law would understand that because it was about harm and her safety.
Yeah.
But in that instance, if that happens now, she will be criminalised, charged with a criminal offence, at risk of going into detention for that offence, definitely on remand, but could get sentenced to a term of detention because she breached the bail condition. Now, I imagine that any sensible children's court magistrates would say, you know, okay, this is crazy.
Yeah.
We're not going to, you know.
Yeah.
But, who would know? Because there's so many magistrates that act as children's
courts. Well, you can't bank on it, can you, Dan?
No, you can't because there's all sorts at... that are judicial officers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's one of the examples. And it's really scary. So for girls and even boys who are at risk being left in these places when the so-called child safety system will not remove them from harm and leave them there because that's your bail because they don't want to find any other address, right?
Yeah.
And or if you do that, we'll put you back in detention because that is housing that we can give you and you can't be turned away from.
Absolutely. And Deb, I think, and I thank you for shining a light on some of the nonsense involved with child safety, because there will be a lot of listeners tuning in today believing in the benevolence of some of these colonial institutions, but we know, having worked in this space, especially you, for such a long time, that they're actually just another way of oppressing people, particularly some of with these law changes that disproportionately impact black fellas, First Nations people here.
Yeah.
Deb, another amendment to the Youth Justice Act is that it is now requires courts to take into account the bail history of a child when determining their sentence, and providing courts with the ability to declare a child as serious repeat offenders and thus triggering a separate sentencing regime. Under these changes, the courts will still have to consider the usual sentencing principles under the Youth Justice Act, but they also have to consider the impact of the offence on public safety. I'm wondering, can you tell us a bit about these amendments and what they mean and how they work in practice?
Look, you know, the courts that we appear in, they do... When they're sentencing a child, of course they take the history into account. Everything's taken into account, okay?
Yep.
The issue that we have is that, you know, in regards to any type of offences now, in regards to aggravation, that, you know, that means it's can be deemed more serious You know, like if you broke into someone's house and it's nighttime, that's mm-hmm. worse than if you broke into someone's house in the daytime, right? So, you know, we have all those types of issues. And serious repeat offenders is about if a child has a history of previous indictable offences, you know, so it takes into a number of accounts in regards to a children's criminal history. But can I just say, children are charged, and I believe overcharged, with many offences. Lots of children can be charged with robberies, which, right? Robbery sounds really, really serious. Yeah. But usually when you read the evidence, many lawyers will write submissions to prosecution and argue that this is a steal and maybe a common assault if it's robbery with violence. Like, it's not a robbery. And the girls that we support at Sisters Inside are charged with these types of offences and sometimes end up being referred to restorative justice.
Yeah, okay.
And when the girls also tell us about what happened, you know, what was the situation, the incident, and it's usually fundamentally started from racism. Mm. So it's usually where the other party, who is then deemed the victim, has called the girls horrific racist names and sexist names, and so there's been a reaction.
Yeah.
So I remember one little one was riding a push bike and her older siblings and friends were behind her, and she went, rode past the bike, rode past a cafe restaurant, and an adult come flying out of there and called her all these racist names and pushed her off the bike and was standing over the top of her screaming.
And pushed her off the bike even.
So all the older girls come running in. They've pushed the adult.
Yep.
And, you know, and it's turned into, and they've, you know, stolen the phone from her that she had in her hand because it really was like an F you.
Yeah.
Because you've assaulted the younger one.
Yeah.
And they run away. Now, that's robbery with violence in company.
And thank you for telling it like it sounds, because it sounds
really, really bad.
Yeah.
Yes. And of course there are some offences that are, right?
Sure.
Horrendous, and we get that. But they're the rarity in this at the end of the day. Well, you know, if you run into a bottle shop, right? A liquor store, bottle shop.
Yeah.
And, you know, kids pull up at a stolen car, they jump out, they run into the liquor store, they take a bottle of vodka or whatever they take that they can in their hands and run out.
Yeah.
That's usually a robbery, right? That's a robbery.
Yep.
And if you push the teller, that's a robbery with violence.
Yeah, okay.
And it's a robbery with violence in company because there's a few kids.
Sure.
So, yes, it's scary for those working in the shops, and I totally understand that, and at no time do I condone violence. However, we got to put this in context. We live in a racial capitalist world of haves and have-nots.
Absolutely.
We're talking about children, predominantly Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, who don't have anything at all, who are living in poverty, majority, and others are flaunting their wealth. And so they want a piece of that, right? They're seeing that on television, on social media.
Yeah.
They want a piece of that.
Yeah.
So the only way they get a piece of that is go in and steal it. But also there's children who are stealing food, for example, that can be charged with robberies with violence, where a little young one that I know, 13-year-old, went into Woolworths and stole some sandwiches and a drink. And, you know, shop security decide to grab her arm and say, you haven't paid for that. So she's pulled her arm back to move her, get her arm out of the adult's hands that's grabbing onto her.
Yep.
That's a robbery with violence.
Yeah, okay.
Because she's hungry. She's stealing food. Like, why?
Yeah.
We live in a very rich country. Why is it that so many children are hungry? That's the crime here.
I agree. I worked, in fact, in the years that I worked in this youth justice space out of a community legal centre, supporting young people. Mm. In fact, a lot of the young people, Deb, that I worked with had been charged or convicted of crimes of what I would call survival.
Yes.
Whether it be stealing food or jumping out of the window of a nighttime because there might be domestic violence in their house or responding to acts of racism.
Yes.
A lot of the, and I agree, when you read some of these, you know, charge sheets, they sometimes sound a lot more horrible than what they are. And I think you make a good point in terms of looking at the context in which we're looking at some of these cases.
Yeah. Well, see, what the government's done has picked and choosed the worst examples, and then the knee-jerk reaction is about all children will pay.
Yes.
And instead of dealing with the issues, you know, that need to be dealt with. Now, we all know that children, the children that we are talking about, have usually been taken at a very young age by the family policing system. They have been in numerous foster care homes where that so-called child safety, I call it family policing, has let them down over and over and over again. So, you know, the family policing system takes an Aboriginal baby and gives it to another family, usually a white family, and pays them to raise the child.
Yeah.
And when they don't want that child anymore, they're disposed of.
Yeah.
That little body is disposed of. Instead of paying the Aboriginal family, all right, if there's issues with mum and dad.
Providing support.
If there's issues with mum and dad, there's extended family in the community. Yeah. Pay the family or the extended family to keep the child in the community, not pay a white family to raise an Aboriginal child. This is where we've got it.
Yeah.
Back the front.
Yeah.
I went to swear then, but I won't.
No, you're absolutely right. And I can absolutely understand the wanting to swear. And also, I think, Deb, the other part, and this is something that shocked me when I was working in that space, is the amount of people that forget or don't acknowledge that young people have developing brains.
Yes, absolutely.
You know? Yeah. I mean, young people are sometimes and regularly held to a higher accountability than some adults are in this country. Yeah. And these are kids with, you know, trying to figure out their way in the world, trying to figure out themselves in many cases.
Yeah.
Deb, I want to ask you about social media because this is something that I think a lot of our listeners might be interested in. One of the most under-examined changes that is being introduced extends measures introduced in December 2022, so not long ago, to criminalise particular uses of social media, including the introduction of higher penalties for people who, quote, boast on social media, unquote, about their involvement in particular offences. This is pretty terrifying. It's pretty unclear exactly what constitutes advertising one's involvement is as an offence. And yet, if you're found to do this, you can face up to an additional 1 year imprisonment. I'm wondering, can you tell us a bit about these changes and what they'll mean in practice?
Yeah, well, obviously, it means if you're recording a so-called crime, then that's what it will mean in practice. But look, we live in a world of social media. Members of Parliament are on social media, posing on the red carpet.
Always.
Out at dinners, at Government House, like wherever they are.
Yeah.
They're posing on social media all the time. Okay, so people will say, all right, but they're not committing a crime. Yes, but it's encouraging and others to use social media. So, of course, children are going to use social media because they've got nothing else to do. We have left these children high and dry on the streets trying to survive. They see this as a bit of fun and having a joke later, right? Like others look at social media. But the harm that this is causing children to be criminalised, it's what adults are portraying as okay. As their behaviour gets displayed on social media, the children do the same. All right, that behaviour may be deemed an offence at the end of the day, but to have a higher penalty, I think, is really, it's scary, and it's also a disgrace considering we all use social media. And government are the leaders in our communities, and they need to lead by example. And the example that they are leading by now is that they don't care about children. They don't care particularly at all about the so-called serious repeat offenders.
Yeah.
When we know that it's about 300 to 400 children. Now, we live in a state, a jurisdiction that has about 5 million or a bit over 5 million people, and we're talking 300 to 400 children. Are you telling me that we as adults, that we cannot support 300 to 400 children and their families? Like, this is an absolute joke.
Yeah.
The girls that we support are part of that cohort, 100, and we have had great success where rarely any of the girls ever get criminalised and put back into custody ever again. But, I mean, the government's not funding the grassroots programs that actually work across this state. They're funding more cops, more youth justice who are surveillance officers, who are bureaucrats.
Yes.
They are not grassroots.
Yes.
And that's what's getting funded. Grassroots organisations and programs that actually work, like Sisters Inside and many other Aboriginal-controlled organisations and small Aboriginal programs that don't even get a cent of funding that are working,
yeah.
but the government's happy to refer the children to do the work, but they won't fund them.
Yeah.
And I know one particularly, not Arakoon, lost me now, just outside Cairns. Oh, my God, sorry.
You're all right. But there's some...
But I mean, there's a young Aboriginal man there who's taking the boys who are deemed these serious repeat offenders out on country. And, no one's assisting him. Yeah. They said to him, would you like a job in Youth Justice? He does not want to work for Youth Justice. They're a carceral response. So what the government keeps funding is these carceral... logics, carceral policies, carceral strategies, which net widens and captures more children. But, I mean, why can't we, seriously, with all the money, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, well, even the $500 million, right, that's been allocated specifically for Cairns to build a youth prison.
Yeah.
And that's why we got the End Toxic Prisons. And we're asking the community to reimagine their community to be able to spend that $500 million there. And they've all said, including those running Facebook pages that are saying do something about youth crime and who are white and hysterical, they're even saying that they don't want to see children harmed and they know that prison harms them.
Why do you think, Deb, Labor government have come in so hard?
I really think it's about... election next year.
Yeah.
I think that, they say they're listening to the community, but they're only listening to a certain section of the community, because if they were listening to the community and those of us that wrote submissions and gave evidence at the parliamentary inquiry, the majority of us said, do not do this, including the Human Rights Commission, all those people and those other types of positions said, do not do this. 85 members of parliament voted that day for this legislation. There was the two Greens that did not, they opposed, and two other members who weren't in parliament that day. So 85, Labor and the LNP joined and agreed on the legislation that is about attacking children, children who have no currency, no power in the political system. That's what this is about, using children to bounce off the backs of the most marginalised children so that they can launch themselves back into, their political seats at the end of the day.
You touched on money, Deb, and, Mark Ryan, Police Minister, has in no uncertain terms said, yes, this will absolutely increase young people being locked up here in Queensland. We know, Deb, that the young people are going to have to be put somewhere. So when we think about all the nonsense that we've heard recently about ex-police officers and security, ex-police officers talking about watch houses, what they've witnessed in watch houses, how young people are treated in watch houses, we know that when youth detention centres are full, people have to stay in watch houses for longer periods of time. Deb, where's everyone going? If more kids are getting locked up, where are they all going?
So you know that crystal ball I've got, just like the cops have got, to reasonably suspect if a child's going to breach a bail condition, because we know that the watch houses are full now, right? And the kids' prisons are full. And what I'm worried about is that the Labor government will commission a section of an adult prison and put children in an adult prison, as they've done in Western Australia, in Victoria.
So wait, Deb, you're saying this has actually already happened here in the colony? So WA and Victoria have
already
done this?
Done this, yeah.
And you can foresee it potentially happening here in Queensland?
Well, I can't foresee anything else other than that because, you know, they've said that they're going to build two new youth prisons, children's prisons.
Mm.
But, I mean, it takes a while to build a prison, right? It's not going to be overnight. And these laws, we're already seeing the numbers of children piling up in watch houses now.
Mm.
And there's no cages in the children's prisons, any of the children's prisons. And all, if not nearly all, the cages are full in watch houses unless the lawyers are doing the work and getting them out. But, I mean, we've got children staying there for weeks on end, you know, and this is a scary thing.
Yeah, and look, we're not... I'm absolutely not advocating for watch houses, for detention centres, rather.
No.
But what we are saying is, you know, watch houses are scary places, Deb. I mean, a lot of our listeners won't realise that young people and adults are locked up for long periods of time, sometimes for weeks, Deb. The lights are constantly on. There's no fresh air.
Correct.
There's no grass under your feet.
Correct.
There's young people don't always have access to education.
Correct.
Access to be able to talk with family as well.
Well, you know, what we've been told is that children are allowed 2 phone calls a week. Mm. And so when a child's in the watch house, Youth Justice is in charge of them.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes.
So Youth Justice is only allowing children 2 phone calls a week.
Mm.
One of the little ones who was in the watch house in an outer suburb, who I represented recently to apply for bail, they had given her a book to read and a deck of cards.
Wow.
Now, I read the objection to bail, and attached to it was a report from school that had been written a couple of years ago. It actually said that they had believed that she probably had an intellectual disability, but definitely learning difficulties that had never been assessed properly. So what does YJ do? Give her a book. And when I read that and I was down in the watch house with her, I said, I just want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Can you read? It's okay if you can't read. And she said, no, I can't.
Mm.
Okay, thanks. Which allowed me to tell the magistrate. So she was sitting in that watch house for 6 days where she was given a book to read and a deck of cards. And it's just appalling. No, like you said, no sunlight,
no phone calls,
no visits.
Yep.
She had visits from sisters inside. She had visits from lawyers, obviously.
Yep.
But, I mean, this is a child. And at the end of the day, she would never be sentenced to a term of detention for the offence that she was in the watch house.
Yeah, that's that part there,
Deb. Yeah, that part.
That part there.
That part is always that part for a child.
Yeah, exactly.
That they're going to languish and spend weeks and weeks, not only in watch houses but in the children's prison, where at the end of the day, if they're found guilty or plead guilty, they will never get sentenced to those terms because of the offences, which are really not significant offences. Yes, the state is declaring them, but at the end of the day, when you unpack the reality of the behaviour, it's not. It's a way that I know that Sisters Inside and other organisations that work with children can actually address those behaviours because, like you said, they're survival.
Yeah.
They're about poverty-related offences.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. So the government needs to step up and address poverty, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Deb, we know there's a massive housing shortage currently and a crisis currently.
Yep.
I mean, it's very hard for humans to excel and succeed in society if they don't have a shelter over their head, right? And what I find really perplexing is it was only a few years ago, Deb, that Four Corners did a full report on the Brisbane Watch House and how they were detaining young people in same spaces as adults, right?
Yes.
And then yet here we are, a couple of years on, the same Labor government have now introduced these massive amendments that are, like we've been talking about, going to see watch houses fill up, youth detentions fill up, and ultimately we know they're going to disproportionately impact blackfellas and black communities as well.
Yes.
Deb, I'm wondering, I'm mindful of time and we do have to wrap up. Is there anything else you wanted to finish on before we go? I know you're an active, you're always active online and bringing attention to some of these stories and wondering if you wanted to finish off with anything today.
I think probably what I want to say to the community is, like, I understand the frustration when children, whether it's your own or your grandchildren or other children, you know, are behaving in a way that maybe not, where you feel okay, please don't ring the police.
Yeah.
The police are not your friend. The racial gendered violence of policing is where it comes from, the invasion of this country, and continues. And, you know, it continues on from not only the invasion, but where Aboriginal and Torres Strait people were rounded up and put in missions, and where when missions were opened, they were pipelined into prisons. And now the mass incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is increasing faster and faster, particularly girls. As an abolitionist organisation, we know that there's ways to support families, communities and children in a way that we don't rely on any form of policing, whether that's so-called child safety, but it's family policing. So if you start thinking, instead of using the word child safety because you're thinking, oh, that's safe, oh, that's child protection, they're going to bring protection, they actually don't. It's family policing. It's surveillance coming into your home. you know, of course, if there's imminent danger and something has to happen, then you make a decision about that. But a lot of the times, you don't have to rely on the racial gender violence of policing. Sisters Inside has been around for 30 years and we have not called the police once. Not once. We have never relied on the racial gender violence of policing, and we won't, because it's about the community that we build, those interpersonal relations that we build, relationships that we build with children, their mothers, their families, and their communities, and we address the issues, the conflict internally, without any form of the colonial state impacting. And that's the only way we can do this. We've got to... You know, as my friend says, Ruthie Wilson Gilmore, who's you know, amazing academic in the US, and you know, where life is precious, life is precious. So please, our children are precious, and we must hold them so they're not harmed by the state.
Absolutely. Deb, thank you for coming on this morning. Thank you for all the work that you do in our communities. And thank you for, Sisters Inside and the incredible work. I mean, I've had my own family supported by you and your team at Sisters Inside. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. And folks, don't forget, we will be trying to get some young people on the show next week to hear from a young person's perspective about some of these YJ amendments, because it's really feeling like the Wild Wild West out here. But until next week, thank you. I'm Kevin Yao Yee. We'll yarn soon. Bye.
No more whispering in our mind.
Let's talk. Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on AAA Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on AAA.org.au, proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.